Okay, so we introduced yesterday the basic framework of Masechta Makos, the way the chapters are laid out. So now we'll jump right into the first Mishnah. Ketzad ha'edim nas in zomamin. It's a little bit of a funny question. How do you have edim zomamin? We know what the case of edim zomamin are, is where witnesses come along and they testify to something that's either true or false, but they weren't at the scene of the crime. And it's determined imanu hayisem, that individuals come and say about these witnesses Reuven and Shimon, they were really with us when they say they witnessed whatever it was that they say that they're witnessing. So what does the Mishnah mean when it says Ketzad ha'edim nasim zomamin? So from the continuation of the Mishnah, it becomes clear that we're talking about a case where we cannot apply the basic principle of justice of edim zomamin. Again, what's the basic principle? V'asisem lo kasher zamam lasos achiv, that you do to these witnesses that which they intended but did not succeed in doing to the victim of their testimony. If they would succeed in doing it, so then already they're out of the category of edim zomamin. Okay, then it's a different story altogether. So we do to them that which they intended to do to the victim of their testimony. So if it's a monetary case, it would be a monetary issue. If it's a capital case, it could be a capital issue. But there are some times that we can't apply that. So let's jump right in terms of the discussion in the Mishnah. It has to do with the Kohen. Me'idin anu b'ish ploni shu ben grusha o ben chalutza. In omrim ye'ase zeh ben grusha o ben chalutza tachtav el aloke arbaim. So let's say somebody's testifying about a Kohen that he's not really a Kohen, that for various reasons having to do with this individual's lineage, he's what we call a chalal, that yes, his great-great-great-grandfather may have been a Kohen, but there was a problem somewhere along the line. So why wouldn't we turn the Edim Zomamin in this case? And it turns out that they're actually testifying falsely, that there's no way they could have possibly known about what it is that they're saying that they saw, something that went on, let's say, with the mother of this particular Kohen, because they weren't there at the time. Why wouldn't it make sense to say that these individuals should now have the status of chalal? A variety of reasons. What's that? Okay. Well, what's the more likely situation? They might not be what altogether? They may not be Kohanim altogether. And even if they are Kohanim, the Gemara explains, you still wouldn't say that they would have a status of Chalal, because the Pasuk says, V'asisem lo kasher zamam la'asos la'achiv. You take it out, the penalty is on them, but if you determine that they were actually a Chalal, then what would the scenario be? It would be propagated forward to many, 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 many generations. So that would, in fact, not be a fair penalty. That itself would not fit into the rubric of Edim Zomamin. Okay, so again, so rather than determine that the individual, even if he happened to be the Edim Zomamin, that is, happened to be Kohanim, we give them Malkus Arboim, they're subject to 39 lashes, so we don't want them to get off scot-free, but on the other hand, the basic framework of Edim Zomamin is not relevant. Midin anu b'ish ploni, shu chayiv galus. Let's say they say, somebody we saw, he accidentally killed somebody else, so he should really have to go to Nir Miklat. And they're saying that this accidental murder took place on Tuesday, but really on Tuesday, we know that they were at an all-day-long, conference, continuing legal education. It just continued on and on. There was just no way that they could have been present to witness this so-called accidental murder. So now the question is, are we going to send them to an Ir Miklat, as they were intending to do to that individual? Ein omrim li galas etachtav, ela loke arbaim. Rather, they should be subject to lashes. And the Bartanura explains why this is. Well, you could say, well, why not send them to Nir Miklat? It's not like the case of Ben Grusha, Ben Chalutza, where the individual isn't a Kohen, or would have implications for future generations. So here, the Bartanura explains that it's based on Xeris HaKasav. Dechsiv Berotzeach, Hu Yanus. He should have to be exiled, Hu Velo Zomimav. So the din of Edim Zomimin doesn't apply to Rotzeach Bishgaga, even though legally you could have made a case. If you were testifying against somebody that they should be exiled to an Ir Miklat, maybe in theory they should have had to go as well. Hu yanus el achas harim ha'el v'chai, and not a zomimav. Midamanu b'ish ploni shegirish es ishto v'lo nasan la ksubasa. Now let's say they're testifying that such and such individual divorced his wife and he didn't make the divorce payment, what we call the ksuba payment. So the Mishnah says about that case, well, okay, are they really threatening this person? I mean, after all, you know, eventually the guy is going to have to pay up. If he dies, so then his estate will have to pay the ksuba payment or the divorce payment. Velo bein hayom bein lemachar sofo litein la ksubasa. So he's going to end up paying in all likelihood unless she predeceases him. So how do we figure out what exactly their damage is? So Om Din Kama Adam Rotzeli Ten Biksubasa Shalzel, Shem Nisalmanal Niskarisha Vimesa Yirashena Bala. So the way that we figure out the damage that is owed to this individual who was accused by these Edim Zomimin of having not given his wife the divorce payment, and it may not be that they're divorced altogether, is that we figure out how much somebody would pay for that divorce payment on the open market. Allow me to explain. Let's say, just going to make up a number, that the ksuva payment is worth $1,000. Now, again, she gets that payment in two of three cases. If he predeceases her, or if he divorces her. If she predeceases him, so there's not going to be any payment altogether. So you might say that that ksuba payment, so it's worth $1,000, somebody might be willing to take a flyer on it, and I don't know, pay $300 for it, and say, I'll lay out the $300 now, maybe I'll lose my shirt, I'll lose all the money. On the other hand, right, if he divorces her, if he predeceases her, then I get $1,000, so I made $700 off the deal. So we make that assessment. We say that's really the damage that was caused her. Yeah, because, you know, it may very well be that he'll never have to make the ksuva payment. It may be that he'll have to make the ksuva payment tomorrow. Should he divorce her tomorrow, or should he predecease her tomorrow? So how do we assess the damage? So the Rambam says, you figure out whatever it would be on the open market. Now, some people will say that, no, what you do is you actually subtract it from the total value of the ksuva. So you say the ksuva is really worth $1,000, and somebody would be able to pay $300 for it now, so really the damage should be assessed as $700. That's a machlokas in terms of what it is the Mishnah means. Just go one more case, and I think Yossi has a question. So again, you have a case. It's good that the treasurer just walked in. Perfect case for a treasurer. So you have these witnesses who get up there and testify. They say, Reuven borrowed $1,000 from Shimon. Nobody's contesting them. They're saying that he has to pay back, Reuven does, within 30 days. And we were present at the time of the loan, we know. Turns out they weren't present at the time of the loan. They don't know. Maybe true, maybe not true. And in fact, the individual, this Reuven, says that I actually have 10 years to pay back the loan. Now, what they're in agreement about is that there's a loan, let's call it a loan of $1,000, that really does need to be paid back. So the question is, you know, are they damaging this individual? Are they damaging this Reuven? And the answer is yes. But how much are they damaging him? The difference that somebody would be willing to pay on the open market to have an additional 9 years and 11 months to make the payment. So you'd want to, you know, have the liquidity and be able to hold on to that and be able to do whatever you want with the money. Who knows, you could invest the money, you could start Google, you could start Facebook, you could start a company that will be bigger than Google and Facebook and, you know, become a trillionaire. And then it'd be good to be able to hold on to the money for another 9 years and 11 months. You have to pay it back tomorrow or within 30 days, you probably wouldn't be able to start that company. And that's the way that we assess the damage. So in all of these cases, it's not a typical case of Edim Zomim where you say, okay, you're saying that so and such person really owes the other person $1 million, and it turns out Imanu Hayisem that you weren't there at the time, so you're obligated to pay $1 million. These aren't straightforward cases, either because the individual wasn't a Kohen, or even if he was a Kohen, you're not supposed to impact future generations. That was the first case. Or because the Torah says, Hu yanus alachas harim ayel v'achai, only the individual in question, the Rotzeach Bishgaga, can be sent to the city of refuge and not the Edim Zomimin. Or these cases involving, let's say, a ksuva payment that in the future the individual may have to make. It just doesn't have to make it now. So the question is, what's the value of that debt on the open market? And then fourth and finally, the case of a loan where we said, you know, this particular loan, you know, if it's going to be paid back in 30 days, is worth a very different amount than if you have 10 years to pay it back. Yossi, you had a question first.
So, when we keep referring to Edim Zomim, yeah, two of them are conspiring together.
Yes.
But what if one of them actually was there and saw it? No question about it. Can testify, I saw such and such happened, or such and such didn't happen on such a date, because I was there, saw it my own.
Excellent
wife.
Question.
And the other guy is conspiring to, you know,
excellent question. There is it's not just a consensus, unanimous view. Ein ha'edim na'asin zogimim ad sheyazugu eskula. That they are not determined to be edim zogim until all of them can be demonstrated to be party to this conspiracy.
Okay.
So that's a very, very important point. And you're really right to use that term. And in fact, And I was reading about this not too long ago, that in American law, it's an interesting parallel as well, where a person does a certain crime, whatever, they'll get a certain penalty. But conspiracy is always held as a much more severe crime. That seems to threaten the system altogether. So you're absolutely right to point that out. It's very good that we should point that out at the beginning of the Masechta, because we'll keep on coming back to this issue. So I'm grateful that Yossi asked that particular question, that what we really need is a complete conspiracy. We need everybody involved to truly have been somewhere else at the time. And that's really when it threatens the system, and that's why the penalties can be so draconian, whereas normally we'll say if somebody commits perjury, so they're subject to lashes. Even though it's only speech, normally you have to have a lot of sheesh for mice to get lashes. But in this case, because of the conspiratorial nature of it, the fact that they could be put to death for this kind of false testimony has to do strictly with the conspiracy, and it's only defined as a conspiracy, isn't really an excellent question, until all of them are involved in the conspiracy. Again, Ein Ha'edim Nasim Zomim and Ad She'Yazuma Es Kulam, excellent point to raise as we're just entering the Masechta Rabbi.